let me throw it, baby. Baby, can't you see love is crazy?
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Brandon Adamson. We're going to be discussing his album and re-release of Birthday Boy. Brandon, great talking to you.
Thanks for having me back on.
So, this album, Birthday Boy, this was originally released in 1996. Were you just starting out as a musician, or have you been working at it for quite some time at that point?
I mean, I had been working at it for, like, maybe a couple years.
Well, the album, not the album, just music in general.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I had been, that was probably my first actual recording release, like a legit release. I had been, you know, tinkering with music before that and playing some shows and stuff. I had friends in high school that were in popular bands, and so I was just kind of like, I kind of wanted to get into that, but I was in a like a punk band for a while, and you know, that didn't work out. And I eventually just decided that I was only interested in doing things on my own because, like you just couldn't you couldn't rely on any of these other people to stay with it. You know, it was kind of a lesson I learned from watching my friends in these bands, as they would get popular and then they would somebody would quit and the whole thing would disband. And I thought, man, like, oh, what a waste. My stepbrother was in a fairly well-known metal band that was like signed to a major label, and they put out a couple of albums, and they were pretty famous. They're you know, you could still find them in like, you know, Encyclopedia of Metal and all these weird websites. But then slowly the band members quit, and then they just you know, eventually they just completely disbanded. And I thought, you know, man, I never want to be in a band, because you could put all this work into it and then it just disintegrates because people decide to leave.
So this was entirely a solo endeavor?
Oh yeah, completely solo. And I'd say even more than solo, it was a work in total isolation.
So you used basically like an old school keyboard for this?
Well, it wasn't old school at the time. I mean, it was a 90s synthesizer or keyboard. I guess it wasn't really a true synthesizer.
It wasn't a professional synthesizer. It was one of those keyboards that are given out more as toys. I mean, I actually have one from when I was a little kid. I'm guessing this one was probably much older, maybe. Who knows when it came out, maybe like the late 80s, like really old. So it wasn't a professional synthesizer. It was a more of a toy keyboard. Did you do that for the kind of a more kind of a kitsch sound, or because you were on a budget?
Well, it wasn't really a toy keyboard. It was like a Yamaha, but it wasn't like, I mean, it was like the kind of thing that would be like a higher end keyboard that would the equivalent of like that you could get like at Radio Shack or something. So it wasn't like, I mean, it wasn't like from Toys R Us or anything like that, but it wasn't really designed for, you know, for professional use, I guess you could say. But yeah, I was totally on a budget. Yeah, I mean, I had no money, so that was a big part of it. But I also was always kind of wanting to do things like the cheapest possible way that I could get away with, whether it be, you know, anything I was working on, really. You know, I mean, the album was recorded on a Fostex four-track recorder, which was brand new when I bought it in 1996. It was just a brand new four-track recorder. But it was still kind of frowned upon, the idea of actually like recording things you were going to release on four track. It was more like that was used for demos and that sort of thing.
So this came from a isolated experience and lack of personal relationships. Where were you living at the time?
Well, I had my very first apartment. I was only 18 years old, and I was living in Phoenix. Now, I had lived in Phoenix during the summers before that, but that was like where I got my first apartment, and I was living alone and going to community college, but I really knew absolutely no one. And so it was a very isolated experience, because not only I didn't really have a huge desire to meet a lot of people, because I kind of was like totally focused on making these recordings and things, because I thought that like that was really all I was really interested in.
So you weren't necessarily depressed. Are you more the kind of person who's able to do well in solitude?
Completely, because I was an only child, and I kind of grew up in a big old house, and I was what you would be called in the 80s, like a latchkey kid, meaning that like both my parents worked, so I would get home from school, and I just constantly had to entertain myself. And even when I was a kid, and I've written about this before, but I used to play games like football and basketball like by myself, but I would construct I would play as both of the teams, and like I would construct like these elaborate tournaments where I would play like these basketball tournaments like in my room in like a, you know, some kind of kids basketball hoop or something, and I would construct elaborate tournaments where I would play as all of the teams like playing against each other, and just all but like completely by myself. Like as I look back on it, it was probably, you know, some kind of undiagnosed mental illness or something, but it was just amazing how like but I just became accustomed to doing things like that completely by myself, and also just being up in my room on the third floor playing Nintendo and stuff just by myself for ages.
And you wrote a lot of songs based on characters by 90s TV shows like Melrose Place, and you were obsessed with E Channel. I mean, I never really watched that show, but I'm familiar with it, but I've never seen an episode.
Yeah, and that actually, I think, gets to the only thing that I think is really interesting about these recordings, and what kind of solidifies them as a product of that time period, is that because I was just completely by myself, I didn't really have anything going on at that time, or I wasn't hanging out with people, I didn't have any real personal relationships. I would write songs about like the characters on these shows. So the song "Right Back Where I Started" is actually about the character Michael from Melrose Place, who for some reason was a character that I identified with.
The personality of the character?
Well, he starts out as a kind of like just like a normal married guy, like a doctor, young doctor or something. Melrose Place, it was kind of a Gen X show where these people in an apartment complex in their early 20s, and he's like, he's a married doctor, and then eventually he becomes depicted as like a villain, because he's like, he has affairs, and you know, his love life, he has these affairs with these different women, and he goes back and forth, and it's just kind of the song is just kind of a chronology of things that the character's relationships and up to that point, and kind of just how he just always kind of ends up where he started, like back to square one within these relationships, like, and then, you know, having another affair and so forth. I don't know, for some reason I really identified with that character, because I I just felt that he was really really complex in his motivations.
As far as the musical influences go, were you influenced by the music of that era, or more past influences?
A little bit of both. I think that it still comes down to that the experience in that apartment. I was influenced by a lot of kind of indie alternative at the time, like I was influenced somewhat by Daniel Johnston only because, like, he had released things that, like, on CD that were just completely, like, the worst, like quality home recordings. And that at that time, that was kind of, that was almost, like, unthinkable, because you would have everyone I knew that was in bands, like, they would never release anything until it was, you know, they had enough money to do it through a professional studio, and they had all their songs hashed out, and he just basically, like, just recorded stuff that he had made up, like, 10 minutes ago, and, like, in his room. So that would, it wasn't so much that I was, like, inspired by his music, but just the fact that, like, it was like, oh, you mean I don't need to follow all of these rules where I have to do all this stuff and get all this money, and then I can record an album. So that, and then a lot of it was also inspired by music that was from some of these TV shows, and like the, I think in at the end of one episode of Melrose Place or the beginning or something, there was like, they do like, there's a video for some Letters to Cleo song, and I remember like trying to make my voice like do that kind of like whiny alternative sound to like match what was on the TV, and that was how some of the sound was achieved on that recording. And I also, the reason my voice is higher pitched is because I sped up the speed of the recordings, like maybe like 5 or 10% or something, because I wanted to get like that really whiny like indie alternative sound, which, you know, now is like really cringy, but for some reason I was like trying to do that. And there was also an older influence of music, because on the E Channel they constantly ran this ad for one of those infomercial CDs, like it was called Sounds of the 70s, and it would run through a bunch of songs on there, and I had it like completely memorized, because it was on like 20 times a day, this commercial. So I'm sure that like the songs from there definitely influence it, because I would kind of try to emulate some of that. But there's also some similarities between some of that 70s light rock and the 90s indie. There's some subtle similarities there in those styles, because in the 90s, a lot of stuff in the 70s also came back a little bit, like the Brady Bunch, and that they remade that.
Talking about the disco era, but a little bit before that, like the mid 70s.
Not the disco, but you know, stuff like the Partridge Family and that. I'm trying to, yeah, I can remember those songs like Beach Baby and yeah, that kind of like the kind of 70s light rock, not the disco.
With 90s pop, wasn't there some, this is not so much indie, maybe indie music as well, but I'm thinking of more mainstream pop in the, like, the late 90s, especially, maybe it was slightly later, like around 98 or 99, there was this influence of a 60s Brit pop. Do you remember that?
Yeah, there definitely was. I was not really, oddly enough, I didn't really become interested in that until later. At that time period, at that period of time, I looked back to more 80s and 70s stuff, and also I was actually very, very present at that period in the 90s. It's one of the reasons I'm nostalgic for that era, is because I feel like it's the last time that I ever kind of felt like I really lived in the present, that I was like, you know, like things that were contemporary and things like that. But yeah.
And with the indie music scene, there's a kind of general perception that I had that it was really associated with the hipster culture in the first decade of the 2000s, but it actually goes back further to the 90s.
It definitely does. It's just that I think that when I was around the idea of what was hip back then, it wasn't what you the same as in the 2000s, like a really like seen hair and like the Strokes and all. It was more associated more with me with like indie, like kind of ska type bands and bleached hair and things like that, like weird colorful sunglasses and things like that, things of that nature, flight jackets, those kind of things, which a lot of that stuff has also come back. But in terms of Birthday Boy, I have to say that so much of that was inspired by the E Channel.
So you mailed out recordings to a major record labels. Can you talk about some of the infamous rejection letters that you received?
Well, it's amazing when I think about it. I mean, that these recordings, I actually mailed them out to like major labels like Warner Brothers and things like that, because even though I had read everywhere that it was like, oh, don't mail out recordings and demos to record labels, they don't care, they won't listen to them, like that's not the way that you get noticed or anything like that, I was like, whatever, I don't give a shit, you know. So I would mail them out to Hollywood Records and like Arista and all these huge labels at the time, and I would go on their websites. I mean, this was in like 96, so it was the web was in its infancy, but you could still go on these websites, and I would actually email them, and I was just really, really aggressive. But I had also sent out recordings to a lot of weird indie labels, and one of them I sent to was a record label called Hopscotch Records, and they sent me like a handwritten letter back, you know, saying it was just kind of these douchey, like punk, like indie dudes, and they sent me this letter saying, like, well, we've received, you know, crappy demos before, but this, like, this one really takes the cake, and like, and we think your like sexist lady killer attitude is really weak, you know, or something like that. Just total like. Thing, and I had this letter for the longest time. I finally lost it, but I had it probably for like 10 or 15 years. But it was kind of funny because the recordings were like, they were bad, but what struck me is that like he didn't like pick up on any of the, like, he took it seriously, like he didn't pick up on any of the irony of like the like I said before, if you were to listen to a song like Haven't Lost My Charm or Right Back Where I Started, and you if you thought that it was like, if you didn't know that like it was about a character on Melrose Place, you know, you would think like, wow, who does this guy think he is, you know, some kind of like you know, some kind of Don Juan or something like that. But that was actually where it was like, it was more like a kind of, it was intended to be kind of this ironic, almost like Leisure Suit Larry kind of, it was meant to have a pathetic quality to it. When you get up and sing a song like, yeah, I've still got my charm, it's almost kind of like a pathetic lounge act.
Have you ever done anything, any music inspired by Leisure Suit Larry?
Well, I would say that some of those songs, in fact, were slightly inspired by that, because that was like after I'd played the game, and one thing that I had remembered from those games is like the really distinct, like kind of 90s like MIDI sound to them, that like if you played one of those games now, you'd recognize it immediately as being like totally from a different time. But I would say that it wasn't so much that I kind of had, if you look at the cover of Birthday Boy, you can kind of see that that image. But you see, really, like, as when I was young, I kind of wanted to, I always felt like kind of jealous of a lot of these 90s like teen idols that were around my age, because I kind of felt like, because I wasn't living in Los Angeles and going to auditions and things like that, that I was like, oh, because I totally had the look as all of those like just those like kind of
like a pretty boy kind of
like the kind of dreamy like 90s like teen celeb, like I totally like, you know, from like a like Boy Meets World, you know, and what's so I like, even though I was a guy, like I would read like 17 magazine and things like that just because like I felt like I could that I kind of belonged in that scene, but I was really very kind of frustrated about it. So I kind of attempted to craft this kind of this image as like it was like an indie, like kind of ironic, like indie teen idol kind of thing, where I use some of that imagery, but and the artwork, but I combined it with like
and the
these,
thing
like,
is
really
the
lo-fi
the indie music scene. They weren't able to pick up on that irony that you were kind of playing this character that was aspiring to be an indie version of a 17 magazine pop star.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't really pick up on that at all. And but I say that and when I used to watch the E Channel, it was kind of like when I didn't mention this at the beginning, but when I got my first apartment, it was just this total like dumpy apartment, which yeah, I don't care because I was like, it's your first apartment, you're living alone, and you're like, wow, this is awesome. But it only came with basic cable, and it came with like the most pathetic cable you could get because the only channels that it had were the Family Channel, C-SPAN, and the E Channel. But that was it. I mean, there was nothing else, like no MTV or VH1 or like ESPN, nothing. It was just not even like TNT or any of that. And it was just basically the E Channel. And because I was like kind of thought of myself as this indie like teen, I would watch the E Channel because it was like I kind of felt like I was participating in the Hollywood like celebrity world, even if it was just like in this really like pathetic way. It was just my connection to it. And so I would like I had another song called Outer Space, which was actually you would never guess it, but the name derived from this episode of Talk Soup that was like themed, like it was themed Talk Soup in Space, like a special weekend edition or something. So I, you know, that's where the name Outer Space came for this song. And that was just a really big part of it. And when I look back at all of the people that I was jealous of, like as teenagers, they almost every single one of them ended up badly. Like Jonathan Brandis, you know, he's completely forgotten. He committed suicide in the early 2000s. This huge, like 90s teen star, and Christopher Pettier, I think that's how you pronounce his name, but he was the teenager in Don't Tell Mom, The Babysitter's Dead, that movie.
Oh, yeah, and, I think I have seen that film a long time ago. Was that with the one with Christina Applegate?
Yeah, and he died also of a drug overdose, and Edward Furlong from Terminator 2, the famous kid, he just became a total drug addict and screw up, and if you look at him now, it's just like a total shell of his former self. And these were people that when they were in their prime, you know, that they were they're just almost completely forgotten. They have almost no following now, except for maybe some of these like old women that are like my age that are still for whatever hung up on some of these guys. But there was also Christopher Demitral, who was the teenage son on the show Dream on HBO, whom I also was jealous of, and he, you know, completely flamed out, and then he became like a born again Christian or something like that. So that, and Ethan Embry from who's the exact same age as me. I think he's maybe like 2 weeks older or something like that. He was a huge '90s star, and he was in like Vegas Vacation and Empire Records and those kind of movies. And he's still around. He kind of has like made a little bit of a comeback, but still like, you know, they're totally flamed out.
I noticed there was a kind of a shift from the sort of like pretty boy look, like slender blonde hair in the 90s to the more like kind of douchier look in the 2000s. Do you remember that shift, and why do you think that was?
I don't know. That's a really good question. It's just kind of like, I really don't know why it was, but yeah, I kind of had like the, when I was a teenager, I had that look of like just the kind of, you know, parted hair that was like, you know, that kind of just Saved by the Bell, like, you know, sort of, that just kind of 90s, like Boy Meets World, Will Friedle, kind of hair. And then, later on, I think it moved from that to like a more, I don't know, just kind of like this gross, almost this gross kind of like MMA kind of look, the douchier, kind of like what you're talking about. And I really don't know why that is. I haven't, haven't studied it all that much. But, you know, like everything else, I mean, things just get shittier as time goes on.
This is the 22nd year anniversary of the re-release of Birthday Boy, so it was not available at all in the time in between.
Oh, it was. I mean, it's available on iTunes.
So what do you mean by if it was available, what do you mean specifically by the re-release? Just the promotion?
No, the... It's actually a few months ago, the cassette was re-released by Captain Crook Records in Oregon. Like a limited edition cassette re-release of it was by a label there. And it kind of took me by surprise because I didn't even really know about it. Like it wasn't, I think it was even like kind of facilitated by Pill Eater, I guess.
So Captain Crook Records, that's like a Bandcamp site, or that's a record company?
It's a legit label, but I mean, I think they have a site on a store on Bandcamp, but they release physical recordings, and they've put out hundreds of releases of kind of weird, obscure recordings, and so. I was pretty stoked about it because it was like, just to see like young people even taking an interest in this kind of stuff, because that's the way when I was young, that's what I did, was we would find all these weird recordings from the past that nobody else had any interest in, and suddenly they would become revived. Like a lot of the bands and things that you think of from the 60s and 70s, at that time, a lot of those bands were just, they didn't really even have any kind of real following, you know. It became like a myth afterwards that developed. A good example of that would be something like the Velvet Underground, which didn't really have much of a following in the 60s, but now they're kind of iconic. Like their albums probably originally like barely even sold anything.
Do you ever feel like you had squandered opportunities and you missed out on some big breaks that you could have had?
Oh, absolutely. I when I was younger and stupid, I made a lot of kind of and part of it, I guess, is just, you know, I still have the same personality, I noticed, but I made some kind of blunders where when I would mail out these recordings, right? Well, it's really almost unheard of to get contacted by a label after you mail them recordings, unless it's just like a polite form letter rejection or something like that. But I had dropped a tape off at this semi-large indie label called Epiphany Records, which was a pretty solid like 90s indie label, and they actually, somebody from there, the guy actually called me back, this A&R guy from there, his one of their producers or executives, and he called me back there, and he was like, hey, I'm really intrigued by these recordings, like I think it's really marketable. Like, I'd like to see it if you play a live show. If you, do you have anything live coming up, I'd like to come and take a look at it or something. So, you know, me being a complete idiot, like, I was just like, yeah, I just don't really have any interest in playing live, like, or something like that. So it was like, all I had to do was set up a live show and come up with some kind of act, and this dude, you know, I would have been, you know, I would have been probably getting something put out on this label that was a pretty large indie label, and I could have been remembered as being on part of this this label's catalog. But no, of course, and like, just idiot me, I talking to this guy on the phone, I'm just like, yeah, well, you know, I don't really like playing live, but if I ever do, I'll let you know, or something that. So totally squandered opportunity just by my own stubbornness. But I still do things like that, and then and it's kind of like when I was in living in Los Angeles and I had landed like a really good agent, and they were like, well, you know, we like the way you look in person, but you need to get you know, we can't pitch you from these photos. We needed to get new photos. And it wasn't like a scam where, like, they needed me to use photos from their photographer or something, you know, some kind of kickback bullshit like that, like, because that actually goes on out there. But it was just like, I mean, the picture I was using was, like, photocopied. You know, it wasn't, like, legit. So, but I was just like, I never bothered to even get new photos. Like, I think I kind of like tried to do it, but just didn't follow through. And it was kind of like, I would have been, making all this, you know, I would have been doing tons of commercials and like making significant amounts of money, or at least, but I was too like, I just totally squandered the opportunity. And I mean, there have just been countless examples of that, bands that have asked me to play shows with them and things like that, and I just kind of like just blew it off, like, oh well, I just don't really have any interest in playing live. You know, it's just my my personality when I look back. Yeah, one time I got a call back from a director, a film director that I had mailed a headshot to, and he left a message on my machine. And, like, I totally just forgot to even call him back. Like, I never even called him back.
So you touched upon this, but you were initially embarrassed or self-conscious by your original recordings, but now you feel vindicated by them?
Well, yeah, because, like, they're, I recognize now that they're, like, a product of a particular time. You know, and I see them in a different context, but for many years after I recorded these, like, there were a lot more recordings that just, Birthday Boy was the only one that happened to survive. I had multiple other releases, like I had a release called Spice Lies and Videotape, and then I had Rebel Without a Life, and those recordings are just completely lost because I had moved so many times that at some point I was just like...
So they were on cassettes or CDs?
Well, some of them, they were on... the masters were on cassettes, and then I had transferred some of them onto CDs. But at a certain point when I had moved, one of the times or something, I was just like, well, whatever, these should probably be destroyed. They'd never need to see the light of day. Like... And, you know, they were gone, but it really makes me mad because I really wish...
It would also be hard to recreate that music from scratch. Like, could you memorize it?
Oh,
it wouldn't be the same.
I could recreate it, but it's just one of those things where, like, I mean, you're a painter, right? So have you ever, like, destroyed a painting that later you were like, wow, like... I mean, I wish I still had that because
you know, whatever it was that you didn't like about it was like you might have forgotten about. Or in my case, it's like I feel like I'm old enough now that it's like people need to know that, like, I was a part of this era. You know, I'm not just that. I've been doing this for a long time. So it's like if you have a painting from 25 years ago or something, even if it sucks, it's just like, wow, like, you know, I've got a painting from 1992 or something like that. And it's kind of, I think it's just kind of puts you in some kind as part of a, it just kind of more gives you a place, I think, in history when it's like, yeah, I've got recordings that were released over 20 years ago. Like, I'm a 90s artist. Like,
so, yeah, you would basically say that the 90s were your era. So I think on past shows you have touched upon the 80s to some degree, but you see the 90s overall as basically your era.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of 80s, like, childhood nostalgia. But I see the 90s as my era because, like, that's really the era where I was, like, kind of a young adult and just extremely present. And you part of, like, the young adults of a generation or the teenagers are kind of, like, the driving force. Like, you can be a kid in the 80s or a little kid in the 90s and be like, yeah, I really – used to enjoy this kind of candy or whatever, this kind of drink or whatever you can't get anymore. But, like, I think that being a teenager and a young adult and actually, like, you know, being part of the style and the scene and the culture, I think that is, like, why I consider it to be my era, because that's just, like, when I was in my prime.
And would you say that Birthday Boy is your favorite recording that you've created?
Yeah, it's absolutely my favorite recording, even though it's musically, like, it's pretty lackluster. But it's my favorite recording because of the time period that I associate it with, of being kind of like a young, kind of budding, like, aspiring, like, indie pop star, and just being, like, young and physically in my prime. And then another thing which makes it my favorite recording is the fact that the songs were not really about anything that was going on in my life, but because they were about, like, some of these characters on TV shows and whatnot, I can look back at them fondly, where some of my later songs that were about specific girls that I had dated or whatnot, like, some of those were passionate songs, but when you no longer care about the person or have any feelings for them anymore, then it's just kind of embarrassing. That's like, ugh, I can't believe I wrote this, like, really pathetic song about that girl. Like, I don't feel anything for this anymore. But because, like, it's about the characters, it's completely, I can look back on it fondly and kind of detached. Whereas I remember reading this interview with Billy Joel, where he talked about how some of his famous, like, love songs, like, he didn't enjoy singing about them because, like, they were about his ex-wife that he didn't really care for anymore. And he said that when he was performing those songs, like, now that he just, like, he's performing them, but he's, like, thinking about, like, what he's going to have for dinner after the show or something. He's not even invested in it at all. So that's the kind of, I don't have nostalgia for a lot of my recordings from the early 2000s and, like, these girls that I dated, like, because I just look back on them and I think, like, you know, what was I doing, like, even wasting so much time, like, hanging out with this chick or something? Like, it was just more wasted time, like. So it's almost kind of painful to listen to, both from a musical standpoint and from a psychological standpoint.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Brandon, do you want to give out the information for people if they want to purchase the music for Birthday Boy and plug some of your favorite songs in the album and which ones are available for listening?
Well, there's only three songs on it on the EP. Unfortunately, those are the only songs that survived. They're actually, the original version had a fourth song, Outer Space, but I've recorded many versions of that, and that particular version was just, like, so lackluster that even for Birthday Boy, it wasn't. I just didn't include it because I think I do plan on redoing that song at some point. But Birthday Boy, it's just a three-song EP. You can purchase it on iTunes. If you buy the version from Captain Crook Records, they also release, like, some of my newer songs on there as well.
I noticed from the Bandcamp site, it's kind of mixed up with songs from Compare and Contrast.
Yeah, I mean, they added that stuff on there, and they added a song called Lost and Jealous, which uses the same, which is a later song, which uses some of the same music from right back where I started, but it's the lyrics are completely different, and it's more autobiographical. So it's interesting. You can, if you get that version, you can. I just, those other songs, I don't know. If you want just Birthday Boy, I recommend just getting it off iTunes or something like that. I've actually been meaning to release it on CD or vinyl. I just haven't had the money to do it as of yet. So when I do it, I will release it on a CD or like a 7-inch. But yeah, you can get it on iTunes, and also, like, pretty much my whole catalog is available on iTunes. There's a couple of 10 or 15 song albums that are not available on there, just because, like, I didn't like them after a number of years, so I just dumped them, which, who knows, 10 years from now, then I'll suddenly find nostalgia for those and try to bring them back, but I doubt it.
Brandon Adamson, it has been an excellent show. Check out Birthday Boy, and thank you so much for being on.
Thanks again, Robert.